You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is April the 5th, the 95th day of the year. 270 days remain till the year's over with. Okay. Holidays observances. It's Accelerate ACL Awareness Among Young Women Day, Bell Bottom Day, First Contact Day, Go for Broke Day, Gold Star Spouses Day, Gold Star Wives Day, Hospital Admitting Clerks Day, International Day of Conscience, International Kids Yoga Day, National Caramel Day, National Dandelion Day, National Deep Dish Pizza Day, National Flash Drive Day, National Kids Yoga Day, National Raisin and Spice Bar Day, National Walk to Work Day, Read a Roadmap Day, Student Government Day. Then we have weeks set aside for various things. It's American Crossword Puzzle Week, APOL's International Pooper Scooper Week, Golden Rule Week, Hate Week, International Dark Sky Week, International Pooper Scooper Week, Laugh at Work Week, Medication Safety Week, Nano Days, National Bake Week, National Dental Hygienist Week, National Egg Salad Week, National Green Week, National Raw Feeding Week, National Wildlife Week, Orthodox Lent begins on Ash Wednesday, which is March 18th, goes to May 4th. Ramadan goes on to the 8th. Testicular Cancer Awareness Week, World Hula Week. Okay, National Cherry Blossom Festival is March 20th through April 14th. Let's see if we got anything else. Famous deaths. 1932, Flora Lamp, New Zealand racehorse. 1964, Douglas MacArthur, an American general. 1992, Sam Walton, my cousin. 1994, Kurt Cobain. And in 2008, Charlton Heston. Weddings, 1614 on this date. American Indian Pocahontas, the daughter of Chipawathan, marries English colonist John Wolfe in Virginia. At 415, that's got it. All that having been said, in 823, Lothar I is crowned King of Italy by Pope Pascal I. 919, the second Fatimid invasion of Egypt begins, when the Fatimid heir apparent, Al-Qa'im bi Amir Allah, sets out from Raqqada at the head of his army. 1242, during the battle on the ice of Lake Peipus, Russian forces led by Alexander Nevsky rebuff an invasion attempt by the Teutonic Knights. That was the German version of the Knights Templar. 1536, Charles V makes a royal entry into Rome, demolishing a swath of the city to reenact a Roman triumph. 1566, 200 Dutch noblemen led by Hendrik van Bederode forced themselves into the presence of Margaret of Parma and present a petition of compromise, denouncing the Spanish Inquisition in the 17 provinces. 1614, in Virginia, Native American Pocahontas on this date married English colonist John Rolfe, as I said a few moments ago. 1621, the Mayflower set sail from Plymouth, Massachusetts on a return trip to England. The Mayflower was financed by a branch of my family. Never got repaid. 1792, U.S. President George Washington exercises his authority to veto a bill, the first time this power is used in the U.S. 1795, the Peace of Basel between France and Prussia is made. 1818, in the Battle of Maipu, Chile's independence movement, led by Bernardo O'Higgins and José de San Martín, won a decisive victory over Spain. Left 2,000 Spaniards and 1,000 Chilean patriots dead. 1862, American Civil War. Battle of Yorktown begins on this date. 1879, Bolivia declares war on Chile, and Chile declares war on Peru, starting the War of the Pacific. 1902, a sandbox collapses in Ibrox Park, now Ibrox Stadium in Glasgow, Scotland. Well, what happened? The whole thing just shut down for a minute. Let's try it one more time. In 1902, a sandbox collapses at Ibrox Park, now Ibrox Stadium in Glasgow, Scotland, led to the death of 25 and injuries to more than 500 supporters during an International Association football match between Scotland and England. 1910, the Transandine Railway connecting Chile and Argentina is inaugurated. 1922, the American Birth Control League, forerunner of Planned Parenthood, is incorporated. 1932, Dominion of Newfoundland, 10,000 rioters seize a colonial building leading to the end of self-government. 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt signs two executive orders. 6101 establishes the Civilian Conservation Corps, and 6102 forbids the hoarding of gold coin, gold bullion, and gold certificates by U.S. citizens. Now, there were two reasons this... The hoarding of gold was enacted. Number one, as long as we were on the gold standard, the president couldn't arbitrarily inflate the amount of money in circulation, and that was a limitation on his power. And number two, the ransom paid for the kidnapping of Lindbergh's baby was paid in gold certificates. If they were outlawed, then anybody who turned up with one would automatically be a suspect. And number two, if gold certificates were outlawed, that would make the ransom worthless, even though it was paid. 1933, Honduran Revolution. The young Hondurans occupy the Casa de la Ville and force the government to hold democratic elections with universal male suffrage. 1936, Tupelo-Gainesville tornado outbreak. An F5 tornado kills 233 in Tupelo, Mississippi. 1938, Spanish Civil War. 2 days after the Nationalist Army occupied the Catalan city of Lleida, a dictator, Francisco Franco, decreed the abolition of the Generalitat, the autonomous government of Catalonia, self-government granted by the Republic and the official status of the Catalan language. 1942, World War II. Adolf Hitler issues Fuhrer Directive No. 41, summarizing Case Blue, including the German 6th Army's planned assault on Stalingrad. Also in 1942, World War II, the Imperial Japanese Navy launches a carrier-based air attack on Colombo, Ceylon during the Indian Ocean raid. The port and civilian facilities are damaged, and Royal Navy cruisers HMS Cornwall and HMS Dorsetshire sunk southwest of the island. 1943, World War II, U.S. Army Air Force bomber aircraft accidentally causes more than 900 civilian deaths, including 209 children and 1,300 wounded among the civilian population of the Belgian town of Mortsel. Their target was the Erla factory, 1 kilometer from the residential area that was actually hit. 1945, Cold War. Yugoslav leader Josip Broz Tito signs an agreement with the Soviet Union to allow temporary entry of Soviet troops into Yugoslav territory. 1946, Soviet troops in their year-long occupation of the Danish island of Bornholm. Also in 1946, a fleet air-armed Vickers Wellington crashes into a residential area in Rabat, Malta, during a training exercise killed all four crew members and 16 civilians on the ground. And as I've said many times, if a plane falls on you, you're having a really bad day. 1949, a fire in a hospital in Effingham, Illinois, kills 77 and leads to nationwide fire code improvements in the U.S. 1951, Cold War. That's when Julius Rosenberg is sentenced to death for spying for the Soviet Union. 1956, Cuban Revolution. Fidel Castro declares himself at war with Cuban President Fulgencio Batista. 1958, Ripple Rock, an underwater threat to navigation in the Seymour Narrows in Canada, is destroyed in one of the largest non-nuclear-controlled explosions of the time. 1966, during the Budapest Uprising. I'm sorry. The Buddhist Uprising. South Vietnamese Prime Minister Nguyen Cao Ky personally attempts to lead the capture of the restive city of Da Nang before backing down. 1971, in Sri Lanka, Jonathan Vimukti Perumuna launches a revolt against the United Front government of Sirimavo Bandaranaike. 1976, in China, the April 5th movement leads to the Tiananmen incident. The April 5th movement, for those who are not familiar with it, was a mass gathering and protest that took place on April 4th and 5th at the Tiananmen Square in Beijing. It occurred on a traditional day of mourning, the Qingming Festival, after the Nanjing incident was triggered by the death of Premier Zhou Enlai earlier that year. Some people strongly disapproved of the removal of displays of mourning and began gathering in the square to protest against the central authorities, and then largely under the auspices of the Gang of Four ordered the square to be cleared. Eventually, it led to the Tiananmen Square incident, where the young man stopped the tanks by standing in front of him. 1977, the U.S. Supreme Court rules congressional legislation that diminished the size of the Sioux People's Reservation, thereby destroyed the tribe's jurisdictional authority over the area in Rosebud Sioux Tribe versus Neep. 1991, an ASA EMB 120 crashes in Brunswick, Georgia, killed all 23 people on board, including Senator John Tower and astronaut Sonny Carter. Also in 1991, Space Shuttle Atlantis launches on STS-37. Their job is to deploy the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory. 1992, Alberto Fujimori, President of Peru, dissolves the Peruvian Congress by military force. Also in 1992, peace protesters Suada Dobrovic and Olga Sukic are killed on the Rabanja Bridge in Sarajevo, becoming the first casualties of the Bosnian War. 1998, in Japan, the Akashi Keikyo Bridge opens to traffic, becoming the longest bridge in span in the world. 1999, two Libyans suspected of bringing down Pan Am Flight 103 in 1988 are handed over to the for eventual trial in the Netherlands. 2007, the cruise ship MSC Diamond strikes a volcanic reef near Niokamini, sinks the next day. Two passengers are never recovered and are presumed dead. 2009, North Korea launches its controversial Kwangmyong Song 2 rocket. Satellite passed over mainland Japan, which prompted an immediate reaction from the United Nations Security Council, as well as participating states of six-party talks. 2010, up to 50 people are killed, another 100 injured in two militant suicide bombings and attacks in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province of Pakistan. The first on an Awami National Party rally in Temurghara. The second on the U.S. consulate in Peshawar. 2010, 29 coal miners are killed in an explosion on the Upper Big Ranch mine in West Virginia. Also in 2010, Space Shuttle Discovery is launched on STS-131, Their job is to resupply the International Space Station. And in 2018, agents with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement raided a slaughterhouse in Tennessee. They detained nearly 100 undocumented Hispanic workers in one of the largest workplace raids in the history of the United States. Well, that ends our little history segment. And as I've said numerous times, I do this because if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. And we got enough problems. We don't need to be repeating things that don't have the intended results. All right. We're going to finish up our Unsolved Murders Week. We're going to talk about the murder of television presenter Jill Dando, killed on the doorstep of her London home. It was happened in broad daylight, and it made headlines not only because she was a celebrity in her own right, but it actually shocked the country. Things like this didn't happen in Britain. Now, during the 1990s, Jill Dando was a popular BBC TV presenter. She had an engaging personality, lit up such programs as Breakfast News, the 6 o'clock news, the travel series Holiday. But she was best known as one of the principal anchors of the primetime investigative show Crime Watch. Each week, she would present the key facts of a recent unsolved UK crime and invite viewers to help police by contacting a special phone number. And Crime Watch was partly responsible for bringing a number of criminals to justice. Just 37 years old, Jill Dando was in the prime of her life and career and getting ready to get married. I mean, she had everything to live for. Her fiancé, gynecologist Alan Farthing, lived in Bedford Close in the affluent district of Chiswick, West London. Dando was in the process of selling her own two-story home at 29 Gowland Avenue in nearby Fulham so she could move in with him. And even though her home was up for sale, she still needed to stop off there to pick up mail and check her fax machine. And she hadn't fully moved in with her intended, but she was close to doing it. On the morning of April 26, 1999, she set off in her car to make just such a visit. On the way, she went to a BP garage and visited Hammersmith Shopping Center, bought a new fax machine cartridge and paper, and two fillets of Dover sole. Her image was captured on security cameras. There's no evidence that she or her car were being followed. She was scheduled to read the BBC 6 o'clock news the next day. But in a tragic twist of fate, her own murder would be the lead story. At about 11:30 that morning, she arrived at her front door. She was carrying a shopping bag in one hand and her house keys in the other. Before she could get the door open, she was seized, pushed down to the ground, and shot once in the head. Her neighbor, Richard Hughes, later told police that around the time of the attack, he heard her let out a very distinctive scream and said she sounded quite surprised. Moments later, he spotted a clean-shaven, well-dressed man with dark hair running down the street. He said he thought the man was in his late 30s or early 40s, about 5'11". Well, unaware anything out of the ordinary had happened, he continued with his day and didn't go and investigate the source of that scream. 15 minutes later, a woman passing by discovered Jill Dando lying on the ground outside her home in a pool of blood, her head resting against her front door. She was immediately rushed to Charing Cross Hospital, but was pronounced dead on arrival. Well, the autopsy revealed the gun had been pressed hard against her head when it was fired. The impression of the weapon's barrel and sight were clearly visible. A single 9mm bullet had entered just behind the top of her left ear and exited above the right ear, embedding itself in the front door. The gun had been fitted with a silencer, but because it was fired while forced against her head, the noise of the shot would have been greatly reduced. And damage to the lower part of the door indicated the victim had been in a crouched position when the fatal shot was fired. Presumably, she had been forced to the ground by her attacker. A bruise on her forearm was also the result of interaction with her assailant. Well, police investigators, some of whom worked alongside Dando on Crime Watch, now had the grim task of trying to identify the and catch her killer. Speculation immediately focused on the motive for the murder. As an investigative journalist and presenter, Dando had come into contact with a number of unsavory characters over the course of her career. One theory was she'd been targeted by a professional hitman. Maybe somebody was seeking revenge. Another theory was that she'd been murdered by a Yugoslavian or Serbian assassin after making a TV appeal for Kosovo Albanian refugees who had been driven from their homes by militias backing Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic. The appeal was broadcast on April 6, 1997, just 20 days before the murder. Another theory was that she had been targeted by a criminal she had helped expose on an episode of Crime Watch. The fact the killer knew to place the gun directly against her head to minimize noise and blood spatter indicated that he or she could have been a professional. Another early line of inquiry examined the possibility that Dando had been murdered by an obsessive stalker. It's an occupational hazard for those in the limelight. Could either be a stalker or a hitman. A lot of theories to be explored. The Detective Chief Inspector Hamish Campbell said none would be left untouched. He led the investigation into the murder. Massive media coverage meant the police were under great pressure to find the killer. Nevertheless, their inquiries were fruitless until more than a year later came the announcement the press and public had waited for. On May 25, 2000, Barry George, 39, described as a local weirdo with an obsession for Freddie Mercury and the rock band Queen, was arrested and charged with Jill Dando's murder. Now, George had come to the attention of police when he called him shortly after Dando's death to report he'd seen a truck acting suspiciously near her house on the day of the murder. Police discovered that George, who was unemployed, had a history of stalking women and some convictions for sexual assault. So as police collected evidence against him, he was put under surveillance. The Texas allegedly assigned an undercover policewoman to talk to George and hoping he confessed to the murder, but didn't have any success. After his arrest, much was made of his local reputation as a loner and an oddball, and he certainly had obsessive aspects to his personality. Had an unusual interest in celebrities and frequently called himself Steve Majors after actor Lee Majors, who played Steve Austin in the TV series $6 Million Man. Also called himself Barry Bosara, that's Freddie Mercury's real surname. Then he began to call himself Barry Bosara routinely after Freddie Mercury's death in 1991. He claimed to be Freddie Mercury's cousin and pestered women who'd worked for Queen's fan club. He also fabricated a lot of stories about his past. Said he would have been a roadie for Michael Jackson, had served in the British Army's elite SAS Corps. In 1983, he was arrested, wearing a balaclava and carrying a knife and a rope, in the grounds of Kensington Palace. Now, those that knew him said he was obsessed with his health and frequently be seen jogging or cycling in the neighborhood. Shortly before his trial, he had an IQ of 75, placed him in the lower 5% of the population, and was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, but that still makes him smart enough to be in Congress. During Barry George's trial, the prosecution stressed the fact that when his flat nearby Crookham Road was searched, they discovered 54 newspaper clippings dating back to 1990 about Jill Dando. But Barry's lawyer, Michael Mansfield, QC, pointed out that George also had a number of newspaper clippings concerning other celebrities. In fact, the articles about Jill represented only 8% of the clippings found in his flat. I mean, what telling from the 670 newspapers found there whether he was more interested in Manchester United or Jill Dando. Well, the fundamental flaw in the argument that George was an obsessive fan is that there's no evidence at all that prior to Jill Dando's murder, the defendant had any exaggerated, special, or particular interest in her. Mansfield emphasized that when his flat was searched, no personal photographs or videos of Dando were found, nor were there any autographs. The attorney made the observation of George was obsessed with Dando. Then he had surely gone out to her house, which was just a short distance away, to take photographs of her, at least attempt to ask her for her autograph. He did none of that. A witness at the trial claimed to have noticed George outside Dando's house several hours before the murder. But the only piece of concrete evidence conceivably tied George to the crime was a tiny trace of a substance reported to be firearm residue, and that was found in the pocket of his jacket. Polyester fiber found on Dando's coat could also come from George's trousers, but that fiber was too common and too small for forensics expert Jeffrey Rowe to be sure. Then Mansfield went on to claim the murder could have been a Serbian death squad reprisal for the RAF bombings of a Belgrade TV station. He then produced an official report that stated that a Serbian warlord had put the BBC director general, Sir John Burt, on a hit list. He suggested to the court the target may have been changed to Jill Dando after securities allegedly stepped up to protect Burt. Well, despite the flimsy and highly circumstantial evidence against him, Barry George is found guilty of Jill Dando's murder on July 2nd, 2001, sentenced to life in prison. An appeal was turned down the following year. Continually protesting his innocence, George took the case to the Criminal Case Review Commission. Forensic science experts now question whether the particle found in George's jacket was firearm residue at all. They decided it was, in fact, no more likely the particle had come from a gun fired by George than it had come from some other source. So a retrial was scheduled, and the firearm evidence, so crucial to his original conviction, was dismissed by the judge. On August 1st, 2008, George was acquitted after serving 7 years in prison. Well, following the acquittal, there was widespread criticism in the media that the police had focused all their attention on trying to prove George's guilt and devoted insufficient time to investigating other potential suspects. According to reports released in 2015, over 100 possible suspects in the murder were never successfully traced by police. These documents showed that some of these individuals included members of the Serbian Secret Service and the IRA, as well as a notorious British gangster based in Spain. And furthermore, 11 men spotted on Jill Street that afternoon were never identified. Michael Mansfield, the QC, said, "I find it disturbing there were 100 suspects who never followed up. To put Barry George in the frame, they had to exclude everybody else." But as I've said many times, often police will get tunnel vision. They will know, gut feeling, somebody is guilty. Then they have to set out to prove it. We've got judges here that have that same outlook. Well, after this information came to light, Alice Beers, a BBC colleague of Jill Dando and a former presenter of the Watchdog Consumer Advice Program, reported that Jill had received death threat letters weeks before she was killed. She said that both she and Jill had received letters from somebody threatening to kidnap and rape them. She said she expected the police to contact her about the letters, but they never did. She said if, as they say, they left no stone unturned, I would have been called. I wasn't. Well, was Jill Dando's murderer an excessive fan, a vengeful gangster, a Serbian hitman? 2009, the BBC revealed that shortly after Jill's murder, an anonymous caller claiming to have killed Jill also threatened the head of BBC News at that time, Tony Hall. 2012, the Serbian angle seemed to become more plausible when the Daily Mail newspaper reported that a Serbian woman, Branka Prepa, claimed that her TV presenter husband, Slavko Gorica, a critic of Slobodan Milošević, had been murdered in a similar fashion just 15 days before Jill Dando. Well, despite intense media coverage in the press and on TV, and a hefty reward for information leading to a conviction, Jill Dando's killer has never been brought to justice. In April 2019, 20 years after Dando's murder, the BBC documentary re-examined the case, but unfortunately turned up no new evidence. Jill's brother Nigel, interviewed on the program, said it's such a pointless thing to have happened. I believe there's no reason, just an act of random brutality, and Jill's in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, let's talk about the Kathleen Peterson murder. It took place in 2001. Well, in regard to her, the initial question was it a brutal murder? Was it a tragic accident? A bizarre... The peanut gallery is tuning up. A bizarre kind of bird strike? Well, the fate of successful businesswoman Kathleen Peterson really whipped up a storm of bitter controversy, and while theorizing, it's never abated. Well, okay. You know, to the outside world, the Petersons had everything. A beautiful home, a living marriage, successful careers. Kathleen earned a six-figure salary as a telecommunications company. And her husband, Michael, was a full-time novelist. Well, the image that they projected to the outside world was shattered when on December 9, 2001, she's found dead at the bottom of a staircase in the couple's North Carolina home. And that the investigation that followed uncovered lies and adultery and financial problems, and another death at the bottom of a different staircase. Also led to Michael Peterson's eventual conviction, although a lot of folks believe there are other explanations for her death. Well, Kathleen was 48 at the time of her death, and Michael was 58. Both had been married before when they met in the mid-1980s. Their meeting was facilitated by their children, who were friends. Kathleen had a teenage daughter named Caitlin Atwater, and Michael had two sons, Clayton and Todd, from his first marriage. He also had two adopted daughters named Margaret and Martha. In 1992, this Brady Bunch-style family moved into a sprawling 14-room house on Cedar Street in Durham, North Carolina. 5 years later, Michael and Kathleen Peterson exchanged vows, making their unit official. Caitlin referred to him as the most ideal parents. After moving into the Cedar Street home, Michael Peterson started writing columns on city politics for the local newspaper, the Herald Sun. His increased public profile prompted him to run for mayor, bid that ended badly following revelations he had exaggerated his military record. Claimed he was awarded a Purple Heart after being wounded by shrapnel in Vietnam, but in reality he was awarded the medal after he had been hurt in a car accident. Well, despite this embarrassment, Peterson still hoped to enter the political arena. 2001, a few months before Kathleen's death, he ran for city council and lost again. When officials moved so quickly to charge him with his wife's murder, he wondered if local politics had something to do with it. If he'd have been in El Paso before they charged him, they would have hung him. Early hours of December 9th, Michael Peterson frantically called 911. He said, "My wife had an accident. She's still breathing. She fell down the stairs. She's still breathing. Please come." Well, police and medics arrived to be greeted by Peterson in shorts and a T-shirt. Said he had spent 3 hours by the pool that night, despite the temperature outside being around 55 degrees. Kathleen is lying in a pool of blood at the foot of the stairs. Blood spatter climbed the walls and reached the ceiling. She was wearing sweatpants and a sweatshirt, appropriate clothing for an out, the outside temperature. And there appeared to be a shoe print and blood on the back of Kathleen's sweatshirt. Peterson was barefoot when the police arrived. His trainers and socks were found next to Kathleen's body. Well, autopsy found Kathleen's head had been sliced open in several places. Medical examiner determined she died as the result of a beating, not from a fall down the stairs. And in addition, a drop of blood was found on the inside of Peterson's shorts. Well, Peterson claimed he was innocent of his wife's murder. He said he and Kathleen had been drinking champagne to celebrate a possible movie deal for one of his novels she had also taken a value. He could only surmise that the combination of the drug with alcohol made her unsteady in her flip-flop-clad feet, causing her to tumble down the wooden staircase. He said he'd been relaxing by the pool, too far away to hear any screams from the house. He said, "I've whispered her name more than 1,000 times, and I can't stop crying. I'd have never done anything to hurt her," he told reporters outside the Durham County Jail. Well, investigators did find alcohol in Kathleen's system, but her blood alcohol content was only 0.07%, below the legal limit to drive in North Carolina. They also learned that Kathleen had suffered from headaches and dizziness for weeks before her fall, and even lost her vision for half an hour at one point. Nevertheless, they claimed they found too much evidence that pointed to Michael as the culprit, including another dead body. 16 years before Kathleen was found dead, a 43-year-old woman named Elizabeth Ratliff died in a similar fashion. Ratliff was an American working as a teacher at an air base near Frankfurt, Germany. And she was a friend of Peterson's who lived in Germany for a spell with his first wife and two sons. On November 25, 1985, Ratliff died after falling down the stairs. As in Kathleen's case, there was a lot of blood on the scene. Blood was all the way up the staircase, according to her friend, Cheryl Apple Schumacher, who later helped clean up. Authorities accepted that death was an accident, that Elizabeth had suffered a brain hemorrage while climbing the stairs. Michael helped organize Elizabeth's funeral and subsequently adopted her daughters. Well, North Carolina prosecutors heard of Michael's proximity to another staircase-related death. They announced that the similarities are too many to be coincidental. They believed the circumstances of Elizabeth Ratliff's death had given Michael Peterson the idea of how to murder his own wife and get away with it. One of the detectives said, "I've got two cases, two women who appear to die the same way, both are associated with Michael Peterson. Lightning doesn't strike the same place twice." Well, frankly, that's not true, but a lot of folks like to believe it. Elizabeth's body was exhumed in Texas. The medical examiner from North Carolina performed a new autopsy. Her verdict? Elizabeth had been beaten to death, and the German authorities overlooked the evidence. Jim Harden, the district attorney who prosecuted Peterson, did a great deal of research into the suspect, a lot of which was severely damning. The couple had $143,000 in credit card debt. That's nearly equal to Kathleen's annual salary. Kathleen had confided to her sister Candace that her company's stock was in free fall and she'd lost $1 million on paper. Well, in addition to those money woes, Kathleen was insured for $1.4 million, which Michael would pocket if her death were accidental. Jim Harden argued that this sum would solve Michael's financial problems and allow him to continue to live the affluent, privileged life to which he'd become accustomed. And then there was another revelation prosecutors offered as the most likely the murder motive. Peterson had a cache of gay pornography on his computer and been emailing men for sex. One of them, Brent Wogamut, who said he charged men $150 an hour to do anything under the sun, testified he'd exchanged about 20 emails with Peterson and talked to him on the phone between August 30th and September 5th, 2001. Wogamut had planned to meet Peterson. Meeting never took place, and he never heard from him again. Wogamut also testified Peterson made it clear he was committed to his wife. If it's an idyllic relationship in this marriage, why is he emailing somebody else to meet for sexual relations outside of the marriage? Was a question asked by Assistant District Attorney David Sachs. State computer experts determined that somebody deleted hundreds of gay pornography files in the days leading up to Kathleen's death and the day after she died. Sachs suggested Kathleen could have found the pornographic photos of the sex soliciting emails on Peterson's computer and confronted him, which would have been a possible motive for the murder. Durham County DA James Harden Jr. pointed to the abundance of blood at the scene as proof Peterson was lying about Kathleen's fate. During the 2003 trial, the prosecutors called to testify Dwayne Deaver, a State Bureau of Identification agent, deemed by Judge Orlando Hudson to be an expert in blood spatter evidence. Deaver told jurors he'd conducted a series of experiments that pointed away from Kathleen and having accidentally fallen and more toward a beating. Peterson's lawyers presented their own blood spatter expert, Dr. Henry Lee, the medical examiner in the infamous O.J. Simpson murder case. He asserted the blood in the stairwell was, in fact, consistent with a fall. Once Kathleen hit her head, she would have coughed up blood while dazed and staggering. And Lee not only theorized Kathleen's coughing fit could have propelled blood spatter up the stairwell walls, he insisted that the amount of blood spatter precluded a beating. Well, no murder weapon was found at the scene, but the prosecutors offered one anyway. Kathleen's sister Candace had given Kathleen a fireplace blow poke, a hollow type of poker that could be blown through, acting like a bellows, as a Christmas gift in 1984. According to pathologist Dr. Deborah Reddish, the 40-inch brass tool was the perfect instrument for inflicting the lacerations found on Kathleen's scalp. Well, the blow poke was found covered with dead insects and cobwebs in the garage during the trial. Subsequent forensic tests ruled out the blow poke as the murder weapon, and no other potential weapon has ever been suggested. October 10, 2003, jurors sided with the prosecution. Michael Peterson was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. His adopted daughters, whose mother's death had been used to prove Peterson's guilt, sobbed in the courtroom, certain he was innocent. Kathleen's family, including her daughter Caitlin, who after hearing all the evidence split with her siblings and believing Peterson was guilty, Kathleen's family applauded the conviction. She and her biological father were awarded a $1.4 million life insurance policy, of which Michael Peterson had been the original beneficiary. Peterson's lawyers kept fighting. Throughout the investigation, they had cooperated with the film crew that produced The Staircase, a groundbreaking French television documentary directed by Oscar winner Jean-Xavier de Lestrade in 2004 that generated worldwide interest in Peterson's case. 2 days after the conviction, his legal team started the appeal process, arguing that evidence connected with Elizabeth Ratliff's death should never have been admitted. They challenged Dwayne Deaver's testimony and qualifications, arguing he had been exaggerating his credentials during the trial. The objections fell on deaf ears in 2011 when Deaver was fired from SBI for failing to report blood test results that helped lead to the wrongful murder conviction of an innocent man named Greg Taylor, who spent almost 17 years in prison as a result. An audit found that over Deaver's 25-year career, he had falsified evidence in 34 separate cases. Paulette Sutton, a nationally recognized expert in blood pattern analysis, testified that Deaver's method was antiquated and unscientific. According to an Associated Press story, she chuckled as she watched videos of Deaver beating a styrofoam head and blood-soaked sponge in an attempt to create the blood spatters found on Peterson's shoes and in the stairwell. Sutton's testimony helped overturn Peterson's conviction. And in 2011, Judge Hudson ruled that Deaver had misled jurors and that Peterson would get a new trial. Well, Peterson spent 8 years in prison proclaiming his innocence, but the prosecutor still insisted he was guilty. 2017, facing the prospect of a trial at 73 years old, Peterson entered an Alford plea to a manslaughter charge. That Alford plea allowed Michael to maintain his innocence while acknowledging there was enough evidence to convict him. The police treated it as a guilty plea for sentencing purposes, but Peterson received less than the 8 years he had already served. That meant he could walk away a free man. He said taking the Alford plea was the most difficult thing he'd ever done, but believed police and prosecutors would do anything in their power to convict him, and I'm not going to put my life and my freedom in their hands. Prosecutors considered the plea a win. Durham District Attorney Roger Eccles said he has been and remains today the state's position that Michael Peterson is responsible for the death of Kathleen Peterson. Well, the Staircase documentary unwittingly recruited armchair detectives worldwide to offer theories explaining what could have happened to Kathleen Peterson that night. Both are split between the two scenarios presented at trial. Either Michael killed his wife or she fell in a manner that caused multiple injuries to her head. In addition, there was speculation Kathleen could have interrupted an intruder who attacked her before they fled. 2003, Larry Pollard, a friend of Peterson's, asked prosecutors to reopen the case because of information pointed to another culprit altogether, an owl. Looking at autopsy photos, Pollard said some of the gashes on Kathleen's body looked like marks from an owl's exceptionally sharp talons. Pollard consulted with ornithological experts who agreed the pattern and shape of the cuts on Kathleen's head looked far more like the results of an owl attack than a fireplace tool. And the species of owl put forward as Kathleen's potential attacker was a barred owl. The adult bird weighs 1.6 pounds and has a wingspan of about 3 feet 8 inches. That is a big bird. Durham County DA Hardin dismissed the theories as completely ridiculous, but owl attacks really aren't as outlandish as they might seem. Kate Davis, executive director of a wild bird education organization in Florence, Italy, said raptors are known to get aggressive when defending their nests and hatchlings. They tend to attack at night. Peterson's 911 call was made at 2:40 a.m. Kathleen was holding clumps of her own hair mixed with wood splinters and needles from a cedar tree. Could an owl have been entangled in her hair? That would explain a lot of the injuries. She could have been attacked outside by the owl and staggered into the house and collapsed at the foot of the stairs. When the SBI eventually acknowledged finding a microscopic feather in a clump of hair in Kathleen's hand, Pollard shouted, "The feather has been found." Well, following Peterson's Alford plea agreement, though, the owl theory will never have its day in court. Peterson himself has said that he's run out of theories. The only thing I know absolutely positively is that I had nothing to do with Kathleen's death. Well, in 2007, Caitlin Atwater and Michael Peterson settled a wrongful death suit for $25 million. It's unlikely that Peterson would ever be able to pay such a large sum. Caitlin said the suit helped to ensure that Peterson would not profit by writing a book about the case unless it became an overnight best-selling sensation. Well, from the Petersons' mysterious death, let's turn to the Long Island murders. A young woman was seen running for her life. After she vanished into the night, a peaceful area of Long Island began to yield up terrible secrets. Now, the marshland that runs along Long Island's Ocean Parkway, a beautiful although desolate stretch of beach highway, is dense. And it was here, hidden away from the eyes of passing drivers, that a serial killer disposed of his victims. And over the course of almost 20 years, the Long Island serial killer, or the Gilgo Beach killer as he was also known, murdered between 10 and 16 women associated with prostitution. The identity of the killer and his motives have perplexed homicide detectives ever since the first discovery of his victim in December 2010. And it's led to one of the most infamous unidentified serial killer cases in recent history. Now, the story began to unfold May 1st of that year. And I'm talking about 2010. When Shannon Gilbert, a 24-year-old Craigslist escort from New Jersey, vanished. Before her disappearance, she had visited the home of Joseph Brewer, a resident of the upmarket gated community of Oak Beach, who had hired Shannon as his escort for the evening. Brewer would later tell police after arriving at his home, she began to act erratically and appear disoriented before fleeing out into the night. She ran straight past her pimp, Michael Pack, who was waiting for her outside in his black Ford Explorer. Several neighbors saw and heard Shannon at night. She ran down the street of expensive houses, pounding on doors and screaming for help. But despite her evident distress, nobody would let her in. Instead, they called 911 and watched as she ran away from the Oak Beach Gatehouse toward the Anchor Way and then into the bayou, completely out of sight. Her behavior led many to believe that she was on drugs or experiencing some kind of psychotic episode. At some point during her escape, she managed to call 911 and screamed, "They're trying to kill me." Well, who she was running from still remains a mystery. In December, 7 months after she disappeared, a police dog on a training exercise led his handler to the first where it turned out to be four bodies wrapped in burlap sacks distributed in the brush alongside Ocean Parkway on Gilgo Beach. Richard Dormer, commissioner of the Suffolk County Police Department, made the comment, "It looked like a car pulled up on the side of the roadway and dumped them in the bushes." And because the bodies had suffered different degrees of decomposition, he concluded, "It doesn't look like they were dumped at the same time. A couple of them been there a year, or a year and a half, maybe 2 years. They're not recent bodies." Well, as news of these gruesome discoveries circulated in the media, investigators presumed that one of the bodies would prove to be that of Shannon Gilbert. The location where the bodies were found is just 3 miles from where she'd been last seen. But that wasn't the case. After they were identified, they were Amber Lynn Costello, 27, Melissa Bartholomew, 24, Maureen Brainard Barnes, 25, and Megan Waterman, 22. And just like Shannon, all four women had been working as Craigslist escorts when they disappeared. Maureen went missing on July 2007 when she left Norbert's, Connecticut for New York City. Melissa vanished in July 2009 after meeting an escort client. Megan disappeared just a month after Gilbert, having placed a Craigslist advertisement, and Amber vanished in September 2010 after arranging to meet a client or offered $1,500 for her services. In an effort to help capture the killer, an online petition asked authorities to grant immunity to sex workers who came forward with information. Well, it became clear that the serial killer's dumping ground had been discovered in April 2011, 4 months after the bodies had been found. An extensive search for other victims was finally launched. Aircraft fitted with high-tech photographic equipment scoured the area while police with horses and dogs explored the undergrowth along the highway and the beach. This search led to the discovery of 6 more victims about a mile east of the other bodies. 4 more women, a non-Caucasian female child between 16 and 24 months, and an Asian man wearing women's clothing. Of these victims, only one's ever been identified, 20-year-old Jessica Taylor. She vanished in July 2003 while working as an escort in Manhattan. Shortly after her disappearance, her dismembered torso had been found in Manorville, New York, about 40 miles east of Gilgo Beach. Her skull, hands, and a forearm were discovered during the search of Gilgo Beach itself. The remains of another victim, known as Jane Doe number 6, were found also found in Manorville and Gilgo Beach. While the police weren't able to identify the remains, forensic experts did determine that none belonged to Shannon Gilbert. Early December 2011, an extended search turned up Shannon Gilbert's purse, mobile phone, lip gloss, jeans, and shoes in a marsh near Oak Beach, several miles to the east of the second group of bodies. Following this discovery, the search for Shannon intensified. Dozens of officers used machetes and a bulldozer was called into the scene, and December 13th, the remains of Shannon Gilbert were finally discovered in the same shallow marsh where she'd last been seen alive. Well, police announced they believed Gilbert had drowned in the marsh and her death had not connected with the others, despite the fact she was found in the same vicinity and she fit the victim profile. Her family was furious at this conclusion and lambasted his premature and inconsiderate theory. In fact, before Gilbert's body was ever found, Commissioner Dormer publicly announced he believed Gilbert had wandered off and drowned. He said, "I think Dormer just wants to Find the remains. Say she drowned and close the case before he retires. That's going to Mary Gilbert, Shannon's mother. Well, investigation drew criticism from some of the victims' families who accused officers of incompetence and inaction. Some even hinted, even hired their own investigators. Shannon's family hired Michael Baden, a forensic pathologist, in order to obtain a second opinion on her autopsy. According to Baden, there's no evidence she died of natural causes, a drug overdose, or, as the Suffolk County Police believe, drowning. He said that there was insufficient evidence to determine a definite cause of death, but he found a hyoid bone in her neck was deformed, which could have been caused by strangulation. He said these structures, the larynx and the hyoid bone, are often fractured during a homicidal manual strangulation. And, of course, since the discovery of the bodies, theories have abounded. Some have speculated the killer was a seasonal worker, a drifter, or a fisherman from Freeport. More lurid theories have also been put forward. There was one that the killer might be making snuff films and belong to a satanic cult. Another hypothesis involved a local businessman who died by suicide days after Shannon's remains were found. Police were quick to deny he was a suspect. He was just a victim of rumor and hearsay. Now, amid the investigation into the murder, Suffolk County Police Chief James Burke resigned, adding fuel to the rogue cop theory. That theory maintains that they were killed by a police officer. Following his resignation, he was arrested for a 2012 assault on Christopher Lulk, who'd stolen a duffel bag filled with pornography and sex toys from Burke's car. After Burke's arrest, an escort came forward to claim he was into rough sex. She alleged that Burke had attempted to strangle her during a party in Oak Beach, a gated community, while Gilbert was last seen alive. Then transpired that Burke had stymied an FBI investigation into the Long Island murders and intentionally kept him out of the loop. So what was he afraid of the FBI finding? In 2016, an attorney for Shannon Gilbert's family alleged that there could be a connection between Burke and the murders, but he was never charged. He had friends. Another suspect in the slayings was Dr. Peter Hackett, a physician and neighbor of Joseph Brewer, one of the last people to see Shannon alive. Hackett lived close to the marshland where Gilbert's remains were found. According to Shannon's mother, Dr. Hackett called her the day after her daughter went missing and told her he was a doctor who ran a home for wayward girls. Several days later, Dr. Hackett denied he'd ever made that call. However, phone records indicate that he had called Mary Gilbert twice following Shannon's disappearance. 2012, Shannon's family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Dr. Hackett in which they alleged that he could have prevented her death. Wrongful death lawsuit is brought by representatives of a deceased estate. It seeks compensation of the person held to be legally at fault for the deceased's death. Dr. Hackett told Mary Gilbert he ran a home for wayward girls and Shannon was in his care. That's according to John Ray. Why would somebody do something like that? Joseph Brewer himself was briefly a suspect since Shannon was last seen fleeing his house in a state of panic. But the police ruled him out. They couldn't find any evidence in time to the killings. One final suspect for at least some of the murders attributed to the Long Island killers, convicted serial killer Joe Rifkin, between 1989 and 1993, murdered at least 9 women in New York and Long Island, disposing of the bodies in the same general areas of Long Island serial killer. However, in the interview, Rifkin denied any of the victims are his. He stated he dumped his victims hundreds of miles apart, not in the same location. He called the Long Island serial killer sloppy for doing it the way he did it. On the fateful night of May 1st, 2010, Shannon Gilbert drove past the marshland where 10 victims of the Long Island serial killer lay while en route to an escort call. The disturbing and mysterious events that unfold over the forthcoming hours would forever link her to those bodies and spark one of the most extensive murder investigations in Long Island history. Numerous newspapers and magazines, a best-selling book entitled Lost Girls, and an episode in the television series The Killing Season, and have all told the story of the 10 bodies discovered along Ocean Parkway. Despite extensive media coverage, the case still is unopened and unsolved. There are currently 6 more unsolved murder cases being reviewed by police that may have links to the Long Island serial killer. And on that note, we come to the end of today's show and the end of this week's show. We'll be back Monday. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great weekend.